From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Trump cannot understand why there's so much bad news about him on Google and has decided to take the internet search engine to task over it. He complained bitterly on Twitter that Google search results for Trump news shows only the viewing slash reporting of fake news media and that, quote, Google and others are suppressing voices of conservatives and hiding information and news that is good. The White House says it is now apparently investigating whether Google is indeed manipulating search results. Google representatives responded saying, "We never rank search results to manipulate political sentiment. The intersection of internet-based information and electoral politics has created earth-shaking changes in the US and even other nations, because our beliefs are constantly shaped by tech companies interested more in money than truth or justice." My guest is Nathan Bomey, award-winning business reporter for USA Today, the author of Detroit Resurrected, To Bankruptcy and Back. He worked for the Detroit Free Press. He joins me to discuss his new book, After the Fact, The Erosion of Truth and the Inevitable Rise of Donald Trump. Welcome to the program, Nathan.
Thanks for having me.
So this complaint that Trump made about Google is interesting because he thinks that Trump is Google is suppressing good news about Trump, and Google says it is not. However, Google does rank its searches. What actually informs that ranking is not clear. It's not known because it is a black box. That's not to say that Trump is correct necessarily, but what do you make of the fact that he seems to have pinpointed the fact that Google controls search results?
Yeah, this is really interesting because the accusation that Trump made against Google, it seems to be pretty baseless. There's really no evidence that this is happening. And in fact, I think it's pretty safe to say it's likely not happening, but it's concerning because it's concerning that he is sort of taking this debate and using it to his advantage, because I do think that we need to have a serious conversation about the power that Google has over what we see and hear and watch online, because the way that they use the search engine algorithms to rank news is extremely powerful. It affects the way hundreds of millions, if not billions of people perceive the world. And so I do think it's important to have those conversations, but there's no evidence that they're skewing the results against him.
And of course, that goes for Facebook and Twitter, where you don't just see your friends' feeds in a straightforward manner as you could once do in the early days of Facebook. There are complex and secret algorithms that determine just whose feed you can and should see, based precisely on how much ad revenue Facebook can squeeze out. And also, of course, the issue of ads themselves plays a huge part. Let's get to the heart of what you write about in your book and what's so critical to our political landscape, which is that the access that we have currently to information is easier than ever. The problem is what kind of information, and are we as humans even equipped to handle such a free flow of information where truth can be so easily manipulated? So how does just the simple access of information becoming so easy, how has that kind of skewed our perception of truth?
Yeah, this is a big concern for me, because in such a short amount of time, we've gone from a situation in which professional journalists largely controlled access to information about the news to a situation in which both Facebook and Google and a few other smaller social media companies have essentially taken control of that gate. They're the gatekeepers now to what people do and do not see. And their values are not necessarily aligned with the values of traditional journalists, in the sense that they're looking to highlight, well, especially Facebook is looking to highlight things that are engaging. So the news feed on Facebook is designed to show you things that make you emotional. They make you happy. They make you sad. They make you upset. And when it comes to politics, it often means that you get really angry. You get riled up, and then you end up in your own preferred corner of the world. And maybe that makes you less susceptible to believing the facts, regardless of the issue. And so, we see that fake news get circulated legitimately, authentically fake news, unfortunately. And then we get skewed articles that are fake. And then sort of once people end up sharing those things more and more, then the algorithms are adjusted so that they show them more and more of that type of thing. This is happening on YouTube, for example. If you go to YouTube and you watch some sort of conspiracy video, then YouTube is more likely to show you that kind of thing again. And that's why I'm really concerned, because those gatekeepers that we historically trusted to tell us what is and is not real, professional journalists, have a lot, in a large part, been diminished on a lot of these platforms.
So it's not that there's easy access to information, it's that the access is manipulated to keep to maximize the profits of these corporations, right?
Right,
And
exactly,
if
because
that in
Facebook is,
turn
yeah.
leads to political polarization, so be it, as long as Facebook's bank account keeps rising.
Yeah, Facebook's in a tough situation in the sense that even if they wanted to play a very productive role in the conversation that we're having nationally about these types of issues, they have to serve their shareholders now, and their shareholders want profits. This is a company that's worth more than $500 billion at this point on the stock market. Google is worth even more. So they have to serve the bottom line. And I think that that's why we shouldn't expect to see any significant changes from Facebook or Google, because ultimately they have to get people to keep coming back to the site. And unfortunately, productive, thoughtful conversations about the news doesn't pay the bills. Getting people really upset, that does. And so, I don't expect that we'll see any significant change.
So then that brings us to what do we do instead? So there's two approaches one can take. They are not mutually exclusive. One can call on the government to regulate these companies. There have been even talks of nationalizing social media platform. And the other is that we, as consumers of the internet, develop very stringent media literacy skills that can and should be taught in school. Like we're taught math and science we can and ought to be taught skills on how to discern the veracity of information we find on the internet. Would you agree that those are two things that can be done?
Yeah, I think education is absolutely critical. And I talk about that in the book. The need to basically start teaching students these old-fashioned journalism principles of validating your sources and, essentially going out and finding alternative sources of information to confirm the things that you've read. Because if there isn't a journalist there to do it for you, then or you're seeing something on social media that's difficult to validate, you have to have the skills now to do it yourself. And so I think we need to teach people those types of critical thinking skills so they can go out there and do it on their own. And in terms of regulation, this is a tough one because I think on one hand, regulation might help because it would force the companies to expose more information about how they're ranking this type of content. But the risk is, what happens when the regulators don't agree with your political persuasion or end up using their power for bad? I mean, you think about it. Just recently now, Trump is saying we should regulate Google, maybe. Well, okay, so maybe we agree that regulating search engines could be a good thing, but what if you don't agree with the regulators? And so then that's a significant power to hand to the regulators. And so it's a difficult situation right now. We're essentially relying on Google and Facebook to regulate themselves. Based on this premise that their reputation is important to them, and so they'll be responsible about it. The problem is we've seen some scandals there already, and so we're not we can we really be sure that they'll make the decisions that are good for society?
Right. We can no longer trust that this government would actually regulate a company like Google fairly. And so and it's interesting because a lot of the conservative news sites that Trump champions are very much themselves purveyors of fake news. And he, as a person who has popularized the notion of fake news, is the most dishonest president in history. The Washington Post has documented thousands of lies. He on average he spews out several lies a day. So it's so interesting to see this president who perpetuates fake news and who champions fake news sites, claiming that he wants to regulate Google. And it's enough to make one want to turn away and stick one's head in the sand, because an ordinary American who doesn't, when I say ordinary, I mean someone who, maybe hasn't had as much or doesn't has never heard the term media literacy, if they can't, if they can, if they feel like they just can't tell truth from fiction, they may want to simply sit out politics, simply sit out engagement in society.
Yeah, I think that's a big risk. And but I want to get back to something you said earlier about the conservative sites that are perpetuating this type of fake news. It's really odd to see the president and some of these conservatives criticize social media and Google for suppressing the content that they're circulating, because I think the record will actually reflect that these social media sources and YouTube and Google have actually been a platform for disseminating and spreading a lot of this content. You know, in 2016, if you look at an analysis by Jonathan Albright, who is now at Columbia, he has shown pretty conclusively that most of the sites in the 2016 campaign that were spreading a lot of this content were conservatively oriented. Now, we have since realized, of course, that some of it was driven by the Russians. But the point is that a lot of that content is actually thriving on these platforms and has thrived historically. So I don't think that conservative content is getting suppressed, which essentially undermines what the president was saying about Google the other day.
Right. In fact, it is unfortunately being amplified. Let's talk about what these companies have done or said they have done to address the criticisms. You talked about how you really can't trust these companies to do enough themselves because their ultimate allegiance is to their shareholders. And yet, given the role that, say, Facebook in particular was found to have played in the election and influencing outcomes in the election of 2016, during Zuckerberg's testimony, he made claims about, sort of admitted that they didn't do enough and are now taking care of it. What people have found, especially journalists like myself, have found in the wake of Facebook saying that it has made changes, is that Facebook has actually gone in the wrong direction. It has actually worked to, unfortunately, suppress legitimate journalistic outlets who feel like they have to rely on social media now to get their stories out, and found that they can't. That's terrible.
Yeah, they have spent the last several years getting journalists to use Facebook as a platform to send the news out, and then suddenly change the algorithm so that it's very difficult to get your news into the newsfeed unless you sponsor the post. So unless your organization or mine at USA Today is willing to pay for the post to get into someone's feed, it's probably not going to be seen. And so
to pay to get it into the feed of someone who has already decided they want to see your information, right? You create a Facebook page, you get people, you know, who like your work to like it. And then you still have to pay Facebook to get them to see something that they've already said they want to see. It's a bait and switch that is, of course, designed to, again, maximize Facebook's profits.
Yeah, and when Facebook actually discussed this change, they justified it by saying that their research shows what people really want to see there is content from their friends and family. And that's fine. But see, my concern is that what that will do is will actually worsen this sort of isolation, political isolation and ideological crisis that we have, where essentially if you're only seeing content your friends and family share, then you're just going to continue to get things that confirm your own biases. And so it'll be harder to have conversations with people on the other side of the aisle, harder to make progress. And that's a serious concern, because that newsfeed is the way that many people interact with the world now. You know, if the average person is spending nearly an hour a day on a Facebook platform, this is a massive influence on the way the world works.
So companies like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google have de facto become the arbiters of truth, of information, of facts in our society today, at the same time that their interests are about maintaining profits. This is a very dangerous situation we find ourselves in. They also, unfortunately, have tried to claim, especially the CEOs of these corporations, these technocrats, as some put them, have tried to claim that they are liberal, socially liberal, and fiercely protective of free speech, and see technology as a tool for a utopian society where everybody has freedom and equality. Aren't they asking us to trust them because they won't reveal their algorithms?
Right. No, there's no transparency there. I mean, it's very limited. At the very best, transparency is extremely limited at Facebook and Google. They do not regularly discuss the details of how their algorithms work, though they'll release some information here or there. But oftentimes, news organizations like ours are left to try to figure out sort of piece by piece how these things are working. And often, by the time we figure it out, they change it again. Google, of course, there are entire companies devoted to search engine optimization. And so SEO companies are literally paid to help you figure out how to get your content ranked toward the top of Google. And that's significant because research has shown, and I report in this book, that if you don't get your link on the first page of the Google search results, the chances that someone clicks on it are next to none. So this is big business.
So we're supposed to trust the Mark Zuckerbergs and Jack Dorseys of the world with the health of our democracies, because ultimately that's what it comes down to. Are we as a species not equipped for this technological innovation that we have unleashed? It feels like the genie is out of the bottle and can't be stuffed back in, and it's overwhelming us and our neural circuits.
Well, I talked to an expert who was sort of in on the internet early in the 1980s, and he said, when the printing press came along in what the 1500s or something, we didn't necessarily that there was societal upheaval for quite a while as people got used to the fact that it was getting easier to spread information. I don't think we've had very long to adjust to the fact that the internet has democratized information and changed the way we interact with the world. So I think that, are we equipped? I think that as humans, we can adjust to this situation, but we haven't had much time. And so I think it's incumbent upon the educators to figure out how to teach kids the way to take a step back, to disconnect from this hyper-connected world, think critically about the information that they encounter.
So let's talk about what we touched on earlier, which is education, which is media literacy. You have a chapter in your book with a great title, Crap Detection 101. What would a course in Crap Detection 101 look like?
Well, when I talked to Howard Rangel, who coined that term, he said it's about actually forcing students to encounter information that they don't agree with, or to encounter inauthentic information, to actually try to sort fact from fiction. So he took his daughter, for example, to martinlutherking.org, which is a site that sounds really legitimate. But when you get there, you realize that there's something off about it. And he showed his daughter how martinlutherking.org is run by a white supremacist. And it actually has extremely, misleading information and fake information about Martin Luther King. So you can't necessarily trust just because the site looks authentic or the organization claims to have authority. And so I think that when we talk about crap detection 101, it's about teaching students and then us as adults how to question ourselves, question what we believe, question what we're seeing. It's critical thinking 101, really.
So, for example, figuring out secondary sources, looking at the authors of a particular report or who might be on the board of a particular organization, and then tracking their background to see what their political bent might be to see if they have an agenda. I mean, so these are the kinds of skills that you and I as journalists have developed as journalists. But because we are in an age where citizen journalism is a thing, it behooves all of us to have the same skills that journalists do in being able to tell fact from fiction.
Yeah, and one basic tip that I liked that was new to me actually was from an educator at Stanford who has researched how people actually use the internet and use it to consume information. He tested his own Stanford students to see if they could determine what when they were presented with some fake information about health, and they oftentimes failed to do so. And these are the best of the best. So that shows you that this concern is not just about, who's educated, who's not. It's about a critical thinking mindset that a lot of us don't have. So, but one tip he had was to we need to actually embrace Wikipedia and teach students how to use it because it's not going away. It's not like the old days where teachers could say, "Don't touch Wikipedia." Now you have to be able to know how to use it. And he said, if you look at the talk tab at the top of Wikipedia, for example, you can click there and then see how people are debating the information that's on the site. So you can, at the very least, see both sides. And he said that a lot of fact checkers actually use this tab to go and to dig into the information. So I thought that was a really interesting sort of practical tip that those of us who don't, do this every day necessarily can use to sort fact and fiction.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up the issue of Wikipedia because it seems as though I remember it being this very sort of early adopter of internet technology, and the people who ran it had that those utopian ideals about a crowdsourced center of facts and information way back when, but it developed this bad reputation. But it is one of those companies that seems to not have fallen into the trap of commercialization. Is that what sets it apart from the Facebooks and Twitters?
I think that helps. I think that that really helps, and I think that they've developed a set of processes to ensure that bogus information doesn't flourish there. Now, do lies or falsehoods end up on Wikipedia? Yes, and no doubt about it. But if you look, there have been studies that have shown that Encyclopedia Britannica has a lot of errors too. So this is not exclusive to Wikipedia. And the reality is, they have actually editors in place to prevent misuse and abuse of the system. In fact, he pointed out if you make a change, for example, to the Israel-Palestine page, it'll get eliminated almost immediately because they have a set of processes in place to make changes to controversial pages very quickly like that. So it's tough. No, I, you know, again, abuse can happen, but it's a site that we need to learn how to use because ultimately that is a major source for how a lot of people investigate what's out there.
So in the meantime, then finally, Nathan, we have elections coming up soon. We will keep having elections every couple of years, and of course, local elections every year. And companies like Facebook, Google, Twitter, YouTube, have a far too great an influence, and often a negative one, on our elections, on polarizing people, on influencing them, on manipulating our emotions, on spewing, inundating us with propaganda. What can be done in the meantime? I mean, do you recommend people sort of try to disconnect from them, or do we push for any pieces of legislation that are currently in the works to get Facebook to not perpetuate political ads, etc.?
Well, I think it is really difficult because I think it would be unrealistic to say that we should all just disconnect completely because the reality is we're human, and now it's almost like you have to be on Facebook to keep track of your family and friends. And so it's hard to recommend that. But I would say I try to recommend to people to diversify their diet of media sources and to kind of, maybe you subscribe to a newspaper or use Twitter, but use it in a way that you're actually going to get a variety of information. And, I talked to some experts who said try to limit the types of information you're consuming on Facebook from people who you don't know. I mean, sometimes it's like we will subscribe to information, and then like if we don't know if the source is valid or not, that can end up leading to the spread of falsehoods in the future because research shows that when you encounter false information, you may realize it's false to begin with, but later on, often you'll end up believing it to be true. So it's so important to make sure that upfront you've got a media diet that lines up with authentic sources. And I think it's not a bad thing to have some in there that might challenge what you believe from time to time, because if we only feed ourselves with information that confirms what we think, then we're not ever really going to investigate and question our own beliefs, which I think is critical.
So, in other words, we should shape our online social network in the same way that we try to shape our real life social network with care, with surrounder,
Sure.
like we surround ourselves with people we want to be around and who we trust in real life. Maybe we ought to apply those same standards in our online lives. Unfortunately, far too many people don't.
Yeah, that's right. And I'd even say, because you think about the way people interacted with information before the internet came along, it was much more difficult to customize the world so that it would be personalized to your beliefs and things. So if you read the New York Times every day, you might see some information you agree with, but you might see something that challenges what you think or teaches you something new about the world. And so we need to make sure that we are designing our media input to make sure that we actually encounter information that we need to know, not just information that we want to know.
Nathan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
My guest is Nathan Bomey, award-winning business reporter for USA Today. His earlier book was Detroit Resurrected to Bankruptcy and Back. He worked for the Detroit Free Press. We've been talking about his new book, After the Fact, The Erosion of Truth and the Inevitable Rise of Donald Trump. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes and our video channel on Vimeo.